believe it is the 7th of February, 2019. We are into the second month of this new year. Time is running for us. This is the Bond Oversight Committee. It is Thursday morning, and we're going to do roll call, and we're going to get rolling with what we have to do. So, beginning with you, sir.
Jim Green, co-chair, here.
Susan Emmons, a member here.
Good morning. Alan Lazo, member of the Bond Oversight Committee and the Fair Housing Council of Oregon. I'm barely here.
We're glad.
Jennifer Chang with the Portland Housing Bureau. Tanya Wolfersberger with Portland Housing Bureau. Molly Rogers with Portland Housing Bureau. Shannon Callahan, Portland Housing Bureau.
So I'm going to give everyone who has the responsibility. Oh, and I'm Dr. Stephen Holton. I'm the facilitator of our process. Let me give those of us who have the opportunity to review minutes from the last meeting, if you take some moments to do so. And while they're doing that, let me remind everyone who's here this morning that this is a meeting that's open to the public. It is not a public meeting. A public meeting is where all voices of all parties have the opportunity to weigh in, be heard, express, share thoughts, etc. This meeting being open to the public means that you have the possibility and privilege of listening in and watching the process of the Bond Oversight Committee do its work, and it will follow along the agenda. Will follow along the topics of the agenda, and there will be a period of public testimony. And our request is that those who would like to, we'd love to have you sign up and come and share. The request is that your discussion be specifically around things that are either on the agenda or things pertaining to the work of the Bond Oversight Committee. If there are other concerns that are related to housing and housing issues and things related to the work of Portland Housing Bureau, I would like the Portland Housing Bureau staff, if you would lift your hand so they know who you are, all around the room. Thank you so much. You got some even behind you. So if you need to engage, they're the folks to grab, corner, and connect with. So good to see you. Glad you're here. Any questions in regard to the minutes?
I reviewed them in advance. I move that we accept them as presented.
I second.
Okay. Moved and seconded. You can just acknowledge it by everyone saying yes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Minutes from the last meeting. Now, officially accepted, we will move to our next item, which is progress updates. And Director Callahan.
Good morning, everyone. It's really nice to have you here for this first official meeting of the Bond Oversight Committee in 2019. We have a very exciting agenda for you today to discuss with you and get your feedback on some of our proposals for a new strategy post the constitutional amendment that voters passed last November. And so before we go quickly into an overview of the progress to date, and then move into some of our proposed strategies for a bond solicitation and generally reaching our bond goals and overachieving, hopefully, our bond goals. I'd like to make sure that you all, I think you could have told, that Molly Rogers has joined the Housing Bureau as our deputy director. Molly will be working very closely with this committee and our bond team with the responsibility for moving this next phase of the Portland bond into implementation. She'll also be working with us on the Metro bond and generally with our affordable housing portfolio. So we are very, very pleased to have her join. And I know she'll say a few things after that, but before I turn it over to Molly, I'd also like to mention one thing. Jess Larson, as you know, has decided to leave the committee based on the work that she'll be undertaking with the Metro bond. And I think we are all very grateful for her service. I will let you know that Commissioner Hardesty has settled on a new appointee for the Bond Oversight Committee, and we will be working to get that person up to speed and then hopefully have her join at the next available meeting She is aware of who her appointment is, and I think I don't think there's any problem with naming her. It's Annalise Kohler of the Oregon Food Bank, who is also very instrumental in both the Welcome Home Coalition and has a deep, deep knowledge of the of this bond from the very inception of a concept. So we're very excited to welcome her. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Deputy Director Molly Rogers.
Good morning. I am thrilled to be here and work with you in this new capacity. As some of you may have known, I was working actually on the implementation of the bonds prior to coming here in my role at Home Forward, where I worked for close to 8 years as the Director of Asset Management and Housing Policy. Some of you may not know this, but I had an earlier stint at the Portland Housing Bureau before it was the Portland Housing Bureau, working on ending homelessness, and that's when I got to know some of the great folks at Northwest Pilot Project and the Fair Housing Council for Oregon, and really learned that there's an incredible amount of passion and commitment at the folks here working. What I ended up doing was spending about 13 years on the other side working to implement programs to house as many low-income people as possible. So I am excited to bring that experience back to the Portland Housing Bureau in this new capacity to figure out how we build and sustain even more affordable housing for populations that are not met in the market. So I'm very thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Welcome, Molly. Welcome. Can we? Looking forward to the work.
Okay, with that, I think we'll turn it over to Tanya, and I will give her the official PowerPoint clicker.
Power. Such power. Good morning, everyone. I wanted to just walk you all through the progress updates memo that you should have received electronically and is in your packet. Hopefully you have had a chance to read through that. I have a few late-breaking updates to some of those projects that I also wanted to share with you regarding the Ellington and the disbursement of project-based vouchers. We actually had 90 interest letters received from current residents at the Ellington for the project-based vouchers there. I think the next steps is that all of those folks will be placed on a waiting list by lottery, with the first priority going to households at 30% AMI and below. And then Home Forward will be drawing from that lottery later this week, and then actual lease-up will start in mid to late February after they've formed a waiting list and they've begun the application process for the inspections that go along with project-based vouchers. So that's exciting update. There's also work in progress on the MOU with Join for the project-based referrals once the property's exhausted the waiting list for current residents. So all of those kind of steps are in place to move forward to get the 52 project-based vouchers in place at the Ellington. We're excited to do that. Another update that wasn't in your memo is regarding the West Wind and the relocation progress. We have our relocation consultant on board, OPC. We had a resident meeting, as is stated in the memo, this last week. We've had already 23 of the 50 households have been interviewed so far, with another 13 that are scheduled for interviews. That's one of the very first steps in that process, is for one-on-one interviews with the relocation consultant to figure out what their housing needs are and their income and so forth. So that progress is happening pretty rapidly on that front. We're delighted about that. Yes, Susan.
What does OPC stand for? I'm not familiar.
It used to stand for something like Overland something, but they just changed it to OPC.
So they have experience doing significant experience.
Yes, they are. They have offices throughout the country, and okay. Yes, they have deep experience.
And then
doing
is
that.
The idea that that's a permanent relocation for the people at the West Wind? Is that the idea?
Yes.
So trying to find them something equivalent somewhere else.
Right.
And then decide what to do with the property.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, need so much work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So I,
those are the late-breaking updates in your packet. We also have a draft of the annual report that should be in your packet behind the memo. We'll be sending a copy out electronically to you all and following up with you to get your feedback on that draft to date. So be on the lookout for us to contact you later about that. Does anyone else have any questions about the progress updates? Yes, Alan.
Actually, I just went back to notice, excuse me, and it looks like that's about the number of, actually it's higher than the number that you may have anticipated for letters of interest. So are all those all folks that were, that are, will qualify at 0 to 30? Because it looked like we, that there's 80 units restricted at 0 to 30, and we thought that was close to what was what we anticipated at the Ellington. Within, right. Then there's only 52 project-based vouchers. So right. If we receive 90, are there some folks that are maybe not qualified?
Likely, yes. I think there's probably a handful of folks that aren't qualified, either because of occupancy or income or something else.
Do you want to add to that? Yeah, just to add to that, we will, the project-based voucher program allows eligibility of anyone who earns 50% AMI and below. We will apply a preference to ensure that first priority goes to folks who are below 30%. But it is possible some households between 30 and 50 may end up getting a voucher.
Susan, did you have another question, Susan?
No.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's all right. I also wanted to just check in on the format of this type of memo and get your feedback if this is a good format for you, if there is other information that we could be including that would be helpful for you all in the future. We'd like to do this more regularly to provide all of these updates.
I guess the only thing I would add is as we do the updates here, we want to make sure they're reflected on the website too for the public, for people going on there. So that we don't have more information here than is reflected on the website.
Stephen, thank you. I think our recommendation after this meeting as well is to take these updates and a synthesis of your meeting and do a quarterly update to the community with some of the information that you have. And also, all of this is available on our website, but to try to do a synthesis that we're sending out to the Interested Bond Oversight Committee list with a community report. Thank you.
So on the annual report, just to be clear, so what we see here is just a draft that's in our notebook, but we're going to get it electronically to review, and then we'll have some time to get back to you. Okay, you'll be clear when you send it out that you want our comments.
Yes, okay. With a deadline for that as well.
Okay.
Give me a time frame.
Okay.
Actually, there was another sheet. It was in the excuse me, the stuff that you sent to us earlier. It has the bar graphs in it, and I don't see it as part of the presentation or the documents. But if those, I think these two things go together, right? That's part of the progress updates. That has like the cumulative versus the goals.
Yeah. You will see it later on today. It is maybe a little bit farther down. We moved it down.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Got it. It's a different second.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's the same.
We have lots of late breaking updates in our chair.
Thank you.
So yeah, it's still in there. Okay. So if there's any, I'll hand this back to Shannon to kind of tee up the next discussion or
I think we're gonna go we have a lot to discuss today, but we know we have a lot of people that are here, and just to kind of set a reminder for you before we start talking about next steps is to kind of go back and give an overview of the bond framework so that we're all grounded in how our framework will then help guide us into the next level of the strategy. So with that, I think Jennifer is going to do an overview of that portion.
Sure. Thank you. So you'll recall as last year we approved the bond policy framework, and it's our guiding post for how we're making decisions and also planning related to bond investments. And so we are remaining committed to achieving the production goals and also our priorities that we set forth in our framework. And I'd like to kind of provide a brief overview of these so that we can have this in the front of our minds as we're entering into the discussion around future bond solicitation as well as our overall strategies for reaching the goals. So the framework calls out a commitment to further our community-wide goals of preventing displacement, of advancing racial equity, and making a visible impact on ending homelessness. And it lays out several priority communities that we aim to focus housing opportunity for through the bond. There's four main communities. These are communities of color, families, which include families with children, immigrant and refugees, and intergenerational households, and also households experiencing homelessness or who are at imminent risk of facing displacement. The framework also calls out several location priorities that, first of all, that when we're looking at prospective opportunities, that we're looking at it through a racial equity lens and seeing whether or not that decision will help to advance housing opportunities for communities of color or not. And then also that there's a focus in investing where there's little or no existing affordable housing resources. We want to balance investments throughout the city, not just focus in one or two areas, and then also consider other data and important system investments like schools, transit, and planned infrastructure in using that information and helping to make strategic decisions about where we invest. The framework also calls out guidelines for development with an emphasis on advancing equity in contracting and workforce. So there's several things. One, just with our City of Portland subcontractor equity program, the city has a goal currently of 20% state certified DMWESB. The Bureau is aiming, we have a goal of having incremental increases up to 30%, so we want to reach and surpass that goal by 2021. There's also a professional services equity goal of 20% of billings. And then the City of Portland also has workforce training and hiring program goals, which are 20% of apprenticeable hours. And then also goals around employing women and minority firms. So these are ones that we continue to have at the forefront and how we're developing our planning moving forward. I think I'll hand it over to Tanya to talk more about the production goals portion of the framework.
Dr. Hope will remind me to turn on my microphone. I'm actually going to kick off a little bit of this section. I think as you remember from your last Bond Oversight Committee meeting, we had discussed with you that we were going to do some research, both from a legal and financial perspective, on how we could implement the changes that the voters passed with the constitutional amendment, allowing us to potentially leverage more funds and change our model. At the beginning of the bond passage and with all of the work with the stakeholder advisory group framework, the assumptions were previously that a governmental entity needed to be the owner and operator of the bond-funded projects. And then secondly, there were also concerns from our financial division about the concept of assets and liabilities being on a being not on under the same entity. With more clarity, that the city would have the liabilities of the bond, but not necessarily own the assets, because at that time, the only other agencies that we could be potentially working with were governmental or quasi-governmental, for instance, like a Home Forward. And so we have been working both with Bond Council, two different bond councils, actually, to make some determinations about how we can pair this program going forward. And then with great support from our Chief Financial Officer and the whole financial team within OMF to help us make some determinations about ways that we could pair these funds potentially going forward. And I will say that we have very positive news, and so we are presenting to you some outlines of a proposed strategy to both change the ownership and allocation of the funds this morning. And this is really kind of the first step for you to hear some of our initial proposals. You'll hear a timeline, and we want to get your feedback as we move forward with the new strategy. So in short, I have the power of the clicker.
You can get the power of the clicker.
So in short, we will be moving to a more leveraged model of private sources. We would intend that any of the land that we have currently acquired that we would be putting out for potential development would still remain leased and owned, would be leased out to a private developer but owned by the City of Portland. And we will be looking to do more of our traditional leverage model that you would have seen in the past, whereby we are opening opportunity to the private and nonprofit development community. So I just wanted to kind of set the tone for you this morning. We're going to go through a lot of information about how that could look, how that is going to look differently from some of our other funding allocations that we have done in the past. This will be, you know, as we go through this, we will be really making sure that we are reaching all of these goals in our stakeholder advisory group framework and the commitments to the voters. And so that will be always at the forefront of how we are making recommendations, and then on the back end, how we are evaluating any proposals that come in. So you will also, just to preview, we intend to ask you to have another meeting with us next month, because I think we know we have a lot of work to do, and we really would like your oversight, advice, and counsel as we move through the next steps. So with that, I...
Question.
Yes. Steven.
Trying to follow the rules with the...
Appreciate it.
So as we transition into this, mm-hmm. it seems to me that this new model is at odds with what we agreed on, with what we just went over with location priorities, where the second bullet point was invest where there's little or no existing affordable housing or resources.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like we will need to go back to the Community Oversight Committee to talk about that? Or is this something where, because historically we've talked about, you know, investing and making purchases where there isn't your money or other things, but now I agree with why we would do the opposite, but I just wonder if that begs the opportunity to have a check-in or do something along the way to bring people along on the same
thing. So I do think we, you will hear from us, we're gonna talk with you about doing check-ins with the community about in a variety of different ways. The stakeholder advisory group that came together doesn't exist. They were brought together for that specific purpose. But we are going to do some checking with the community. I think the concept of location priorities where there's little existing affordable housing or not the resources, if we go back and dig deeper into the framework, I think you'll see it's very specific into URAs that may still have funds for you. So for instance, and things have changed since then. Right now in the interstate urban renewal area, we are close to now exhausting our funds, whereas 2 years ago we would have had funds still available for allocation. South Waterfront URA, for instance, is an area that we have some existing resources right now. So I think how I interpret that is if a proposal were to come in from South Waterfront, that there would be an available pot of money that were not bond funds that could do that project. That may not be the project, that would not maybe be a priority as there would be at another existing source of funds. So I do think we can check with this concept. Frankly, as we talk to you this morning, we're gonna tell you a little bit about some of what we think are priority areas of the city, especially based on what we don't already have. So, but if you think we need to go deeper into it, we're happy to revisit it as well. So we're kind of open to hearing what you have to say. I mean, I think, We have a lot of thoughts, and we're trying to reinterpret and touch in with the community to make sure that we're still on the right track. I don't think we want our work to be static, At the same time, I don't believe we want to go back and revisit all of the goals of the framework. I think we, I think they can help provide us a lot of guidance, I hope. So.
Thanks. I'm a little curious, actually, both Stephen and Shannon, I'm curious to see why you think that this impacts the location priority, because the ownership framework doesn't necessarily drive where things are located. I think the intention of partly of that location priority was not to concentrate affordable housing in areas, to make sure we get it, especially into areas of higher opportunity. But the change in ownership framework doesn't necessarily drive where we're locating things, unless you're saying, Stephen, that these are private developers that already have projects kind of in the pipeline that might not give us as much freedom to choose location. Is that what you're thinking?
No, I guess I was speaking more to leveraging of other funds.
So actually, the actual
money. In the location priorities, we talk about, you know, making investments where there's not a lot of other options for funds.
Right.
But as we're going to get into, it sounds like we want to actually do the opposite. And so if something was in a URA or an opportunity zone where we can leverage and have a different structure of ownership as well, that someone who's trying to get caught up and hasn't been along the ride with us for the last year may be like, huh, that seems like that might be different. So that's all.
So, Stephen, just to clarify, we have not made a determination on this, but our assumption is, frankly, that we would not be pooling other of our resources. So if there was something in an opportunity zone or something from the state that were coming in or another source of leverage funding, but we would not be looking at this, at least that's our general feeling, to supplement another base level of funds other than what we've discussed in the past. So as you know, the West Wind, for instance, we have a defunct URA that had an existing little bit of pot of money, so we were able to buy or purchase the land. We have a similar situation. There's a couple of very old, bizarre URAs that don't have been kind of mushed around over time, and so they may actually only have a few properties in them that exist. So there are places that we may bring that up to you, but in general, we would not intend, for instance, to pair these with a home or a CDBG fund. But I do think there are places that, if we all go and examine the very strange old existing URA maps, that it may make some sense. But in general, I don't think we would be looking to do that. But hopefully, with the next part of the presentation, we'll give you some thoughts, and we're definitely open to hearing what you have to say. I mean, if you think that that's a valid thing for us to be considering, we're happy to entertain that as well.
I just want to be clear, for existing urban renewal areas, that would still not be a priority for bond dollars.
So I think I want to refer us all back to the actual SAG framework if we read it. So it's very specific about where they thought that there was existing large pots of money, and it was very specific that there were certain URAs where there was not large pots of money. So at the time, the SAG framework, and I would really want us to actually go back and look at that language very clearly, because it's a little bit more delineated than a bullet, but it was kind of the point I was trying to make about the North and Northeast. At the time, there was a large amount of money in the district to do a number of different projects. The URAs have changed over time. So we'd be happy to update you on where South Waterfront, for instance, is an area that we have the ability, we think, to do two different projects before the end of the district, substantial size projects. So on a priority for us looking at that, we would look to try to use the source of funds that was available in that district as a first. You know, Lentz is a district that no longer has a significant amount of resources on the rental side. Gateway has never had a significant amount of resources. They still don't. Gateway was specifically called out in the framework to say not. I'd like us to go back and kind of read that through, but I think there is a question about how we interpret that.
I guess I just want to be clear, like, Prosper Portland should not take the new flexibility in the bond dollars to mean they don't have to invest their urban renewal dollars in affordable housing. Does that make sense? Sorry, that was a little love them, I want them to stay committed to their
affordable housing. There is no portion of that in the discussion with Prosper. All of our Housing Bureau has a base level of 45% at minimum of any new urban renewal area that was created, and everything else is already resolved. And frankly, this is not a discussion that has occurred at any level with Prosper. In conversations with their executive director, as we look at new urban renewal areas, we're all aware that 45% is the base level that would apply for the Housing Bureau. So just so you know, and frankly, these funds will be exhausted much sooner than any new urban renewal area that's even in discussion could be raising new funds. So if, you know, I know there's a large discussion in the community about a few different areas, whether if they would like to consider an urban renewal area, and those funds would take quite a bit of time to generate. These will all be spent and people living in buildings before those would come to fruition. So the answer is no. You're welcome.
Alan?
So we do have the framework in the first tab. And the location priorities, I think you're right, Shannon. I don't think the little blurb quite captures exactly what you're saying about the URA and TIF dollars, but the location priority notes from the SAG do. Mm-hmm. And so we might tweak that bullet a little bit to capture
what you're saying.
But it definitely talks about the concentration of low-income housing, but the first bullet actually does talk about URA mm-hmm. and TIF dollars and that intention.
I just want to further clarify the this discussion around private versus public resources that we would like to leverage. And as Shannon articulated, we're not asking our other partners to come in with competitive other public resources that may be tied to a geography. Our hope is to be able to leverage private resources that generally comes with like low-income housing tax credit, equity, and also a, say, private mortgage that is not tied to a geography at all. So the intention is to continue with the work that the framework, that's why we went and talked a little bit, taking a step back. These goals have not changed. The goals is to advance affordable housing in a variety of different neighborhoods that may not have the opportunities to have those concentrations in the past or those investments in the past. And we will, when we are going to talk about the solicitation in just a little bit, we are going to talk a little bit about where we haven't had investments yet, and that's where we will look to prioritize for the solicitation.
I know we need to move on. I want you all to know, though, that this is actually very interesting to us. We have the majority of our funds that we've ever released out in this way have always been tied to a geography. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we have used small pots of federal resources, and then recently we had construction excise tax, which was the first time that we had a non-federal source of funds that we were able to identify projects for. Both of those projects ended up being, by the way, on the Powell Division corridor, which we're very excited about, because that was one of our priority areas generally, overarchingly, for the Bureau. But this does bring up kind of the crux of some of the interesting ways that we want to talk about how we're going to structure this, because we've never had a citywide source of funding that was able to do multiple projects at a time. I mean, frankly, we're able to maybe eke out one or two citywide from our home or federal resources. So the concept of having this many projects is going to be very, it's going to take a lot of balancing to make sure that we're reaching some of these geographic goals and priorities. But it's a really good point of discussion for us, and we've been muddling with it a lot. So. With that, we'll
can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Because of the comments that you made, I guess what I summarize it as, the strategy sounds like it's to try and go wider rather than deeper, right? By not stack, because you could conceivably stack these funds onto other PHP investments and do some super projects, right? So it sounds like the strategy is to go wider rather than deeper with the projects that you're looking at.
Yes. I mean, I think we want to make sure that we are able to maximize all of the potential for affordable housing, and I think that there are significant other resources that we have. There are resources in other districts, and we want to try to make sure that we are reaching those goals as well as reaching the goals for the bond. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The power.
Okay, so we're going to walk you through some of our strategies that we're thinking about to get us to our goals for the remainder of our bond funds. So as you know, our completed projects are the Ellington and the 105th and Burnside that we've already identified. The proposed projects to be developed, we've identified as wanting to be bond projects. We believe that we will continue to move forward with those some under this new reality that we get this new ownership structure. So we're still looking towards proposing those projects to be developed under the bond. And here is the lovely progress measures that Alan was looking for earlier. So this is really just to say, like, here's we are the completed projects, and the darker green are the Ellington, 105th, and Burnside. The other ones are the proposed projects to be developed, and so you can kind of see where the combination of all five of those projects gets us along the path to meeting our overall goals. So breaking those goals down into some of the larger pods, how we propose to get there for family-sized units, we have a goal of 650 units. We have 275 completed within the Ellington and 105th and Burnside. That leaves us 375 units that we will look to distribute under this new ownership strategy through a solicitation process. Kind of funneling down to the next goal of 30% AMI, a little bit more detail in here of 600 overall units. 300 of those, or half of those, are would be supportive housing units, which would get us to that goal as well. And then we have 400 vouchers, as you know, to apply towards those 0 to 30% AMIs. We have 96 of those units completed. They're all family-sized at the Ellington and 105th and Burnside. Gives us 504 remaining to distribute throughout the remainder of our solicitation. And then that leaves us down, funneling further down into our supportive housing goal of 300 units. We have a goal of 300 units. We believe that we would, 240 of those would be designated toward chronically homeless adults or individuals, and 60 for families. And we've got 29 of those already in process, all family-sized units so far. So that leaves us with our remaining units. Again, 244 adults, chronically homeless adults, and about 31 left over for families. So we base some of those higher percentages for adults based on some data of the shortage of PSH in our community for single adults. So that's kind of why you see a little bit of a big swing between those two numbers. So based on the 2017 point in time count that shows individuals without children comprise about 84% of those who are counted. So we're kind of following those ratios in terms of how we're proposing to implement the PSH throughout the bond program. And so if you look at that through PSH, what we would propose is three standalone permanent supportive housing projects for adults. Westwind would be one of those, and then we would have we would look to complete two additional projects to meet that our overall goal. Shannon, you want to interject on that?
Yeah, we're going through this rather rapidly, mm-hmm. What we're trying to give you is really how we are breaking out each part of the main goals that involve specific targets for 0 to 30 for family size and supportive housing. As you know, you may recall, the supportive housing goal was not an original part of the bond solicitation or the bond referral, but it is an important piece of our work that was added during the stakeholder advisory group framework. And some of overlaying the PSH onto the rest of it kind of drives some of the strategy, and particularly when we get to buildings at a certain level of supportive housing, I think we could talk a little bit more about how the buildings run from an asset management standpoint and from the
and from the view of the tenants who are living in them, but there are certain best practices that we are, that are guiding our creation of this plan. And they relate to making sure that we have, you know, once you reach a certain number of supportive housing units in any particular complex, it makes more sense to actually have the services be fully robust on site. You may then need to, or frankly, you do need to have 24-hour on-site property management. You know, the level of need to manage that building goes up and makes financial sense to bundle folks in a particular building, and also makes sense from the perspective of the individuals in that building to receive the most robust services possible. We also typically, best practice shows about how you mix individuals with supportive housing with families who need supportive housing. So our general strategy, as you see here, is to scatter the supportive housing for families throughout the portfolio and to do some concentrated projects for individuals and couples for intensive support housing services focused on chronically homeless. I'm looking at the head nods, but that's kind of what we wanted to kind of have you see where we're driving to based on practices. And then this actually helps us determine how we're going to structure an RFP, what buildings we're going to be looking for, how we're going to set up the goals for making sure that people know we're seeking family-sized units, what the levels of 0 to 30 support they'll be getting. It'll be a very structured approach. And so anyway, I just wanted to make sure that you kind of understood why we're getting a little bit to this point. And I'm looking to my great team, who actually knows much more about best practices as they relate to supportive housing and asset management, to see if they want to weigh in or if you have any questions.
Yeah, I would just reiterate that we did go through some of these best practices and policy decisions when we were tenanting up our proposed tenanting plan for 105th and Burnside. And we talked with you about our decision of why we were focusing all the PSH on the family units there, and our following best practices to not mix individual and family PSH, and kind of talked about the percentages and the kind of the thresholds of what would tip it one way or the other in terms of our choices. So I think that was even maybe last April or May when we met. You may reference information in your packets about that to help kind of refresh some memories about our discussions around that. So this is just a further reflection down that same path of where we're heading in terms of our proposed strategy.
I just had a question in terms of the supportive, and I know you have a lot of experience with this, Molly, about as a referring agency and as an agency that works with chronically homeless and might be funded by the joint office, is the idea that they, once they get the people, the individual, the family placed, that someone else offers those services, or do they, because they're already funded, isn't there a way for some of that in our existing system, that support to all? I mean, I understand there needs to be more support in the building, but it seems like we already have a system that's funded, and people who are case managing families or individuals.
Yes, absolutely, Susan. So that's, we are going to be working very closely with the Joint Office of Homeless Services. That's part of really the critical piece as we move forward with having unprecedented capital dollars and now having operating support, is bringing that services alignment piece as that final puzzle piece that we are working with them on. So it's really working with them and on perhaps a couple different models, but really making sure we're supporting their system of providers who are experts in supporting people who are experiencing homelessness and moving through their path of self-sufficiency, wherever that may mean. And so it's pairing those partnerships and with those housing operators. It may mean, you know, still may mean some resident services coordination at that ground level, but making sure that the case management and that those relationships remain in place as people move from homelessness into a housing support kind of situation. So we will be aligning, that's the next set of work that we are actually going to be working on, is making sure all those pieces are codified and clear, and how someone is not just is referred, but also supported over time.
And Susan, just to note, the two active buildings where we have family PSH are being supported by the joint mobile housing supportive housing team, which is a collaboration of many of the family providers. So they are maintaining connection before and after. And they are funded, and we are working with the joint office. But frankly, they are not funded to the level to meet all of these goals. I mean, I think we can, I just want to make sure that everybody understands that the full commitment for addressing all the supportive housing needs in the as planned in the bond portfolio will take additional resources for the supportive housing plan. Mm-hmm. They're not funded to the level that we will need to reach all of our goals overall.
And just a reminder too, the West Wind right now is being operated by Central City Concern, and they're bringing a comprehensive set of functions between case management and other kind of clinical services as well as property management. We will be part of this effort to reinvest in that property is to to continue having some kind of operator that can provide, that we know that we have services and property management. But it will mean the additional resources from the joint office to have that level of care, so we know that people are well supported. That's the linchpin of this whole plan. So it's just a quick summary as we move forward on how we're going to actually achieve our goals. I'm kind of starting to think of all these goals as sort of Venn diagrams, various Venn diagrams and very layers of how we are going to achieve all of them. But in short, we're looking at three PSH standalone projects, in addition to about 6 to 10 other properties that will have a blend of family size units as well as some other smaller units. But we will also do about of those outside projects that aren't 100% PSH, we're looking to have at least about a third of them be at least restricted at 30% and below, and be able to continue our PSH goals as well within that framework. So what everyone is waiting for, how are we going to get the money out the door? moving on to, so I am excited to share with you some of our initial thinking, and I would love to hear your thoughts on ways we can further refine. We are in a place where we want to be able to move quickly, but we don't have everything totally in place yet. So this is a really good milestone moment for the community as we continue moving through these goals. We are hoping to have two ultimate solicitations to get the rest of the bond dollars out the door over the next couple years. The first one, our goal is to have an actual, what we're calling a bond opportunity solicitation, be issued in mid to late April. There's a lot of work we have to do in advance of that. So we'll be doing some outreach work with some of the stakeholders that helped guide our framework, and also critical partners for us to move forward, such as service providers and the contractor community who can help advance our equity goals. We would like to have another meeting with you, actually two more meetings before we issue the solicitation to make sure we're all on the right path.
One of those meetings is already scheduled, just so you know.
April 4th.
Make sure that's in your calendar.
Yes, we're already set for April 4th. That's evening meeting.
The deadline will be then sometime in June. Hopefully, we'll have awards in August, and then that will start the work of getting financing and so forth. It will still take a couple years, of course, for those projects to get off the ground. Then the hope is sometime next year we will do another solicitation. And really apply the lessons learned and really ensure whatever goals we haven't met by this first solicitation are achieved by the second one. So we'll be 100% across the board at that point. This first solicitation in April will be, our hope is to have a combination of city-owned properties, the ones that we've acquired along the way, the ones that we have identified as projects in the works, and also allow opportunities for developers who have already have control of other sites to be able to come in citywide to apply for funds as well, as long as they are able to achieve the very prescribed goals that we've set out through the bond. Yes?
Oh, can you give some examples there?
Can you give some examples of the sponsor-controlled sites? Is that like Central City Concern or?
It could be any developer out there. There are probably 10 to 20 that have specialized in affordable housing along the way, and some of them have sites that they already have control of. So we are working with the we have lots of conversations with the various developers all the time, and we're trying to get as much information of their pipelines as well to make sure that they're aligning with our location priorities. We will apply our location priorities first and foremost, but some of them do have either vacant land or they may have sites under a contract.
It's a quite common phenomenon for them to be any affordable housing provider or developer to have options, or potentially they've had a property in their portfolio for some time. We don't have any agreements. We don't have any exclusive relationships. It's with any of the development community. It would just be an open call, and I would imagine it's not just something they would have in their control, but something that they might not have in control and would be potentially trying to get an option to meet some of these priorities as laid out by the solicitation.
I guess I just would want to follow up on that. Is there going to be any sort of like vetting process, or I don't know, like guidelines in terms of who could be a sponsor for a sponsor-controlled site? Because I feel like there's a wide variation of developers and
yes, there is. We're giving you kind of high level overview of what we would expect on the solicitation. On the back end, even though they will have differences from some of our previous NOFAs, there is a very rigorous application process with financials, with team experience, with making sure that someone is either able, if they're a new entrant, that they're bringing partners who know how to own and operate a building. I mean, it is not just kind of, hey, come in with your proposal that meets this. It is, that's why the timeline is so long from April until, we give a couple of months, because they're very detailed packets. And we'd be happy to give you some examples potentially of packets that have won solicitations in the past, awards in the past, so that you may have a familiarity. They're usually about this thick. And there's a significant number of different things that we require, including your marketing plan. I mean, there's a lot of detail to those. So yes, we are very cautious of that as well. And I think that's part of our, we also want to get you kind of up to speed on some of that. We would not intend to lower any of our current standards that we use in terms of evaluation, but we also want to make sure that there's clear prioritization of what we're looking for as the Housing Bureau and the keepers of the bond funds. So
I wonder if for this first solicitation, if there's an opportunity to work with existing property owners who have 4 to 12 unit properties, I think specifically in North Portland around Fessenden and St. John's. There's a number of property owners who already have buildings that they're renting out. The lease rates that they're currently doing would qualify under 60% AMI, even 30% AMI, but they're not bankable. And in order to be bankable, they would have to increase the rents that they offer. So I wonder about for those folks that can't go and get a bank loan, but have an existing property where there's units already on the market where people wouldn't be displaced, but the building needs some repair. That would probably, I'd imagine, be less than $100,000 per unit. It gets us new permanently affordable housing units. It gets them a building that is in better shape. What would be the opportunity for property owners like that?
Well, I mean, I think we're definitely, we would not be looking to use these funds for anything that was existing regulated affordable housing, so that would not meet that. We are very open to acquisition and rehab strategies as well, or potential rehab strategies if someone had something. 4 and 12 units, I'll be frank, sounds really small. With our funds, we will trigger federal relocation assistance. And so as what's happening with the West Wind, we will, you know, any kind of use of our funds would trigger an announcement of that type. And, you know, it would depend on whether or not they could actually do the rehab with tenants in place. But it may not be as cheap as you, as least costly as you actually think. But we are definitely open to that. I mean, part of, I think, our strategy, besides new development, we're talking a lot about new development, and I think Molly can tell you a little bit more. But we know that an acquisition and rehab strategy is also important. So maybe you could touch base a little bit on your thinking, Molly.
Yeah, I also just wanted to mention, you know, we're meeting so many different types of goals all within this one, this incredible opportunity. So we are going to be looking to see how many of our sponsors will be able to serve that 30% of 30% goal, some of which may not have vouchers, because we have a goal of 600, but only 400 vouchers. So that's going to be part of a lot of the due diligence process, is really understanding the commitment and ability to serve extremely low-income populations, as well as a cross-subsidy type of financial approach within just a building. So that ends up lending itself to sort of some larger type of projects. But we know that with the original goals, we're going to meet our overarching goals, which means it's probably going to be a combination of new development and some acquisition rehab. Obviously, there's pros and cons to each approach. New developments tend to cost higher per unit, but you also don't have the potential of displacement implication. So we're sort of balancing that in an effort to ensure all of our goals will be met in these two solicitations. So within that, so we're still it seems like a large range, but we're still figuring out between 50 to 75 million. Part of that is really understanding our unit production goals. So be tied to that. We want to have some flexibility in here, so we know people can come in and ask for either a new development or acquisition rehab, and then we can sort of balance out a little bit of what that subsidy per unit will end up being. We do see a wide variation of what that subsidy per unit will end up being. So we're trying to create flexibility for really the whole community, so we can ultimately achieve all those goals. And part of what we're still mulling over is how many total units, and which will of course mean how many total projects. So we're not trying to be too restrictive. But knowing that we have really robust 30% goals and really robust PSH goals, we're trying to allow some flexibility around size of projects and type of projects that may come in. But we're also cognizant that we have, if you go back to that, you know, there's that map where we currently have projects slated to be bond funded, and right now we're identifying a few neighborhoods that are really underserved. So within that map,
lots of people.
There we go! Yay! Lots of different blue and green in here. I like it. But as you see, we've got some nice diversity now. We really don't, you know, Stephen, to your point, we don't have really anything in North Portland. Northeast Prescott is the closest, which is, as you know, North Portland is its own distinct fifth quadrant of our community. We have also besides some West Wind and downtown, we don't have anything in Southwest identified, so that will also be a priority geography. And then we want to continue supporting the work that we're doing in East County, or I should say East Portland, and understanding those tend to have unmet needs as well. So continuing those three geographies, but would love to get your input on that as well.
I would say, for my daily job, I'm seeing commute times becoming a bigger and bigger factor for people going to work, but also having time with their family. And so for me, I would love to see a priority made around North Portland and being able to house people that can work on the west side of the region, but also on the east side of the region, as opposed to, I think, a lot of the folks that are impacted in East County, they can find East Portland, they can find housing, but their commutes are still pretty bad. unless you're close to the MAC stations.
Thank you. Any other?
Stephen, it's just we've tried so hard to find a building, and through the prior incarnation of the bond, and we've been prioritizing all of these three areas that you hear, but it's been really interesting for us to see the lack of ability to find anything in the St. John's neighborhood that we really could parcel together. So we're hoping that a lot of the units have just been too small. They're not large, but if you know of anybody too, please help send them our way.
Going back to outreach activity.
A quick question. So are the city-owned properties going to compete in the same on the same?
Oh, go back.
On the same plane as the in that solicitation.
So what we have here is it's very common for us to have. We often let out properties that the Housing Bureau owns or has acquired and put them out in a solicitation. And so what you will see here are the three projects that are being developed. 30th and Powell is well down the forefront. We have an architect and we are working with Home Forward on that project. We are frankly having some conversations with Home Forward about that project in the long term. Our interest as the city is frankly not to be an owner and operator of affordable housing. It's really not the best fit for our organization, and we think there are partners that can do that. We'll be talking with you a little bit more about those plans once we know what the potential solicitation number is, what kind of the parameters are around each of these proposals, so that we're trying to put a level playing field forward, but we are having those conversations. The Prescott and Westwind, we're going to talk with you a little bit about the timing of those, but we are anticipating putting those out for private development. So we would put them in the solicitation and say, here is the criteria, here is the dollar amount, please give us your best proposal for creating the housing and operating this housing long-term for the best needs of the community. Obviously, we've talked about Westwind from the very beginning as a supportive housing, so we'll be very specific about that. The Prescott property in Cully is likely to be more oriented toward family-sized units. So people will make a proposal based on the properties that we put out instead of just bringing their own. And so that's kind of what we are contemplating. We also, it's not part of the agenda today, but there also is a opportunity for us. I think we want to have further dialogues with you about either properties that we also currently own that we would want to put out in a solicitation, or the opportunities that may arise for us to purchase a property in one of these key areas that our partners don't have that we would then put out for development. So for instance, there has been a property that we have been working on in Southwest Corridor area for quite some time. The RFI committees that we used when we were looking at owning property had approved it. The owner then said they weren't interested in selling it. They're now interested in selling it again. And we have an exclusive arrangement. So it may somewhat look like a hybrid where we would actually buy a property and then put it out for solicitation. So that's one of the things I think we want to have as we kind of move to this level, as opposed to, this kind of strategy, as opposed to us just being the acquirers and owners and operators, how we kind of merge those two. When it comes to properties that are being considered on the private market that we could not have a public discussion about because someone else may take that property or get a wind of that property, and property negotiations are usually also confidential. We would probably, we would be recommending, I think, we convene an RFI committee again of the same type. But there are going to be those situations that I think we're going to have to work through as we move forward to this strategy. So, there are other potential non-governmental entities who bring us potential partnerships as well. With a parcel of land, which obviously, if they meet our criteria, we would want to take advantage of land from other governmental entities. So I think we'll have to work through this with you a little bit, but you may see us acquiring more land if it meets the criteria to try to get to our goals. There's a dearth of people being able to find anything in North Portland right now. So if we were able to find something, we'd probably try to jump on that too. Thank you. I do. Would you like a Kleenex?
Just, I would love to update you briefly on the plans that we have in place to do some outreach activities, because we're trying to be responsive to the need and get as many units off the ground. We recognize we need to also reconnect with some of our stakeholders. Outreach will be really three purposes. One, to update participants on the progress of the work we've done so far, and also inform partners of the upcoming bond solicitation process. We also want to get more input around the overall process and considerations for location and various strategies for how we meet minority-owned businesses and culturally specific organization participation, so we can meet all those goals as well. These are some of the stakeholders that we had initially reached out to: MACG, OPAL, community engagement liaisons, also the better understanding the current pipeline of various different developers. Also, we need really strong alignment with the joint office so we can make sure that the services are there. Also, other supportive service providers, to Susan's point around making sure people have a continued relationship moving forward. And also really quickly potentially convening some of the work that we generally do every year of helping to match some contractors to where we have contractors and subcontractors that are advancing WSDB goals as well. So lots of outreach very quickly, but our hope is, and this is a little bit of a, our hope is, and it's a little bit of a sliding scale because we still have various things to figure out and ranges, but this will this shows where we hope to end up at the end of this solicitation process. So we'll be advancing our overarching number of unit goals. So it would be well over, closer to the 75% mark. The 30% goals in PSH, we will continue need to accelerate those that work. We're looking to do vouchers that help align really our PSH goals and 30% goals, and then where we are in terms of family size units. So just kind of keeping our eye on the prize and how we're really tracking our progress. And how we were going to get to 100% with all the rest of our remaining dollars. Alan?
Thanks, Molly. I wanted to wait until we got to here a little bit to ask about a couple things. One, I think when we show these progress ones, I think it's, and I think there was a version, again, that came to us that showed the dollar spent. So I think it's fair to show the progress of where we are on dollar spent, too, because and that's not to say that it's out of whack right now, but it's in line from what I saw in the graph that we had earlier. And so I'm curious about the family size unit, because that's what I noted, actually, again, in the earlier version, because in our completed projects, we're at 275, and this one, the production goals of progress, we show 100 units in proposed. So does that come from this 80 to 180, or are there properties that we aren't discussing yet? And so how did you get to the 100? Because that gets us, you know, much more in line with family-sized units. And I think we're not talking about a property today, right?
Right now we're not talking about Powell.
Well, no, but there's another property that was in the... Okay.
Right, so what this is, does not include, so this is just for the, this is 275 is how many we've completed, and through this solicitation, we're hoping to get another 80 to 180. What's not included in that number, though, is the work that we've already done with Home Forward on the Powell project, which is reflected in that progress of family size units in there. So it's a little bit of, it's a moving, this moving target approach, and so there's work that we continue to advance and the projects to be developed, and we're just trying to isolate the goals for just the solicitation in this slide.
So does this 100, this 100 can't represent 30th and Powell, because 30th and Powell is only 50 units, right? So and the programming would have...
Yeah, actually it'll be about 180.
Oh, okay, so Powell's 180, so we might get 100 out of...
What's that?
Oh, Prescott.
It does not.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Powell would be in addition.
Oh, yeah. In addition. Powell would be in addition to this.
So this one is, this is Powell, and then, so then you'd have another, got it. Okay, so then we'd be way above.
Yeah.
Potentially after
Powell.
Oh, got it. Okay.
That'll be another
So we'll be well over 75%.
Yeah, if you put Powell on here, you'd be out here.
We're almost there, yeah.
Yep. We could certainly do a slide that has all all of them in a bubble.
But more
it is a moving target. Appreciate that. But just to kind of high level, what our overarching goal for this solicitation, as we did already really discuss, we would love to see funding for 200% PSH buildings to further our PSH goals. West Wind, we have identified as a project we'd like to include in that solicitation, and we have what we call Project A, to be determined. Still need further refinement of that. We'd also like to include the Prescott project to then have a developer to put that concept together for us.
And I think, Ellen, what you're alerting to is the potential of Project A. We have some ideas for Project A that we want to have discussions with you about and provide you some more information.
Yeah.
When it comes to finding locations for solid 100% PSH buildings, we want to make sure that they're located as close as we can to other other services, amenities, and really transit-rich areas of the city, just because folks need as much access as they can. They're, you know, they won't have cars. They won't, you know, there'll be a lot of things that they're going to need that can't be provided on site. So we do have ideas for Project A. And as we look at where we're siting, you know, these 100% buildings that support prioritization for chronically homeless, it's going to be, you know, a big portion of location priorities. I mean, there's a myriad of places that you can put these type of projects. We're doing a supportive housing project in association with the church, actually on Powell Boulevard. And a local developer, which we're really excited about. But anyway, so more to come on the exciting Project A.
And then also, we're hoping to fund then 3 to 5 projects that that a developer will come in and see how they can respond to meeting the various goals we have set out for family size units and for 30% AMI units goals. So the things that we're still factors to be determined, things we're still deliberating, hence why I think we're thinking about another March meeting, is thinking through a subsidy cap per unit. That will, of course, will inform how many units we hope to build through the solicitation, but there are a lot of factors that go into a gap number, but the general goal is we need to make sure we have numbers that support our 30% goals and our overarching unit production. There's still a question on how we deploy vouchers for the 100. We have 400 vouchers, but 300 PSH properties. So we are units, and we will of course want all of those folks who are coming in who are chronically homeless to be subsidized. But it does allow, there's some questions around the use of the 100 non-PSH, but obviously very low, 0 to 30 population. Where do we spread that out, by project or by population? Services alignment is really, like as we mentioned, is a linchpin to our PSH goals. That work is critical to ensure people are supported over the long term. And then there's, as Shannon already mentioned, we're still thinking about the best location and the right strategy for the 100% PSH buildings. This gives you a sense of our current thinking right now, the various strategies, the overarching Venn diagrams we're trying to adhere to, but also recognizing that this is a point in time and there's still some things we need to figure out, but we're trying to be as responsive as we possibly can, and hope to hear some of your additional feedback.
Man, it just seems like you guys should find something to do. There's just no work happening at all. Questions from Oversight Committee. There's been much covered. Susan.
Oh, I'm sorry. I need to go back to the report. I'm just curious again about the report. So there are going to be two reports. There's going to be one crafted more for City Council, and then there's going to be a public report. Is that the idea? Or are they going to overlap? Or I'm sorry. I should have asked this when we were on reports.
That's okay.
Earlier.
Yes, that is correct. Yes. Okay. So there'll be an annual report of a Bond Oversight Committee and a report to City Council, and then we will also do a little bit very aligned but a slightly different report for the general public.
And are those going to come out at the same time, or will the city council be first and then?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And then in the report, in addition to sort of showing the buildings and the units, will there be like a graph on occupancy, like how they're leased up and all of that? And I mean, is, you know.
We can contemplate that. You know, we don't have that currently in the bond oversight committee in a report, as you can see from the draft copy that you received.
Could you expand on what you're thinking with that so we can get a better sense?
Well, I think in terms of city council, it's one thing to say we've got these buildings, and then it's another thing to say, here's the Ellington, and now you're looking at placing the vouchers, and you've got all these people responding. I think that's really interesting information, that there's that level of interest, even if it hasn't been decided. I think that the 150th, the one that we went to, and there were families, and there were that eloquent speaker. I think to try to capture that, I mean, Mayor Wheeler was there, but I don't think there were other city council members there. To capture a story like that, to say, here's what we've done, now here are the number of units that are occupied or if they're full. I think that's just very compelling information to show we're responding to the need with these buildings. We're doing really well, and here's how full they are, at least at this point. If they opened on this day, if that could be worked in, I think that
would be great. And I also, it makes me think about the actual, your presentation when you go to city council to do your presentation in March. The mayor's office did go back and actually take a video specifically of the woman that you were mentioning.
Oh, yeah, she was
who had moved in, and it's they did a nice video that I'd love to share with you, and it may actually be a good thing to show. She toured her unit and talked a little bit about her experience, and it may be a good video entree to your presentation if you think that would be good. That we could not just have you go up and kind of give your static report, but actually show what she had to say about how her experience has changed from literally living on the street to the shelter system and then into permanent housing. Yeah. So I'd love to see how we can incorporate that for you.
Okay,
thank you. That helps.
Yeah.
All right, any other questions from the Oversight Committee?
I would love to follow up and offer up doing some sort of like road show where maybe we do a tour of some of these areas with whether it be bureau staff, or we have a new city councilor right now, to give people, you know, kind of a hands-on, eye-on-eye feeling, because I think some people think this is really, really easy and why aren't we farther along? And other people are like, this is a drop in the bucket. Why should you be giving this your time? As opposed to, it does come down to the stories of families that are in transition, and definitely seeing making a difference with that woman and her family was awesome. And I think that's an opportunity to get more people engaged in the very serious work that we're doing. And so I'd be happy to give my time in doing that, and maybe taking a small group of people to different parts of the city. So they can see how this kind of stuff plays out. And also, I would urge you guys to, the contractor engagement needs to happen like yesterday, because everyone's still really, really busy. But I also, to be honest, think that there's still a level of distrust when you say city project with a lot of contractors, that it's going to take some work. And so I wonder about engaging the Nate McCoys of the world to start, you know, kind of smoothing over those lines and helping people get engaged right now, as opposed to the opportunity came and then it was gone and people didn't apply and they're already busy anyway, so it's easy to kind of slough off. But those are missed opportunities that we should be able to take advantage of.
I'm looking at Bobby Daniels, actually, who's not prepared to speak today. But Bobby, would you actually talk maybe a little bit about some of the, for lack of a better term, some of the speed dating concepts or other things that we're mulling around?
Turn your mic on.
Bobby Daniels, Capital Project Manager for the bond here. We've in the past have had the speed dating concept used for our soft cost consultants, architects and engineers, where we have them at an event that we call Meet the Developers every year to kind of engage with our typical nonprofit developers to get them in the door and get them in front of people that they typically don't see. We're going to do that again this year. I think in addition, we've been talking about procuring a third-party DMWSB technical assistance provider, potentially the Nate McCoys of the world, Owami, those are groups to kind of go out and do those deep searches for companies that are less, that need to be certified for us to make it work and that know the actual capacity of those contractors. So I think we are definitely looking towards those opportunities to make those dollars go to those businesses. We are also changing, hopefully changing some of the requirements for the workforce training. It's been a sort of I won't say contentious, but there's definitely two sides to the story for the thresholds that is that the city holds for workforce training. It's sort of a blessing and a curse, and so I think we've gotten the okay to pilot a program where we've increased the amount of the threshold to $300,000 for subcontractors who have to do the apprenticeship program, and so that allows more of the small companies who just have their basic employees to actually get on these jobs with less paperwork and less of a red tape that the city is known for.
Yeah. Excellent. Any other comments from the Oversight Committee? Well, we're at the moment where public testimony is available. 2 minutes per. For those who'd like to interact on this quite packed agenda, quite a bit of information, valuable information being covered as strategies are unfolding and opportunities are being seized trying to make this bond come to life. I don't have any names. Was there any a person who's here would like to take two minutes and express? All right, since we're being rushed at the table, everybody's running to the table, we have no space. I think we're okay. Did we want to talk at all about March date and propose? Or do people need to examine your calendars? Or is it pretty open or pretty easy for you? Take a look. Moment.
I know I'm out the week of the 14th or
20th. If we were to keep our traditional approach and attempt for the first week of March,
is that too soon? What's the first Thursday in March?
The 7th.
Well, that would work for me, but I'm retired.
There you go. 1 month from today, March 7th.
Stacy? I
got it.
Does that work for you, Stacy?
It works for me.
it may not work for our meeting rooms.
Right. I will
change my schedule.
Really?
I will.
Okay.
This is a
problem. I'm not trying to force you, Director Kelly.
No, that's fine. It is enough advanced.
Wonderful.
We think March 7th.
March 7th, yeah. I believe.
9 to 11.
Sure.
That works for each of you.
Okay.
Excellent work, everyone. Well, I appreciate your time. Any other comment?
I'd like to do a little bit of what's next, if we may.
Absolutely.
Just kind of summarize besides the March 7th meeting. So I think you...
apologize. So I think you've seen the factors that we still have to bring you back for proposals. We will be getting feedback during this time period from the community and then also meeting with some of our development partners. We are having a meeting, I think, on March 13th with Housing Oregon, which is a conglomeration of nonprofit housing providers, to talk through a little bit of this. That will be after your meeting. It is, just to know, it is atypical for us to have the actual solicitation process designed. We will not be sharing all of the final, getting... we will not be previewing every little detail with the community. There's a lot of technical things. We'll be happy to share with you what our thoughts are on that. But we do want our making sure we're reaching our overarching goals and getting feedback as to whether these are realistic. A subsidy a cap on subsidy is going to be unusual. We have had caps on the total development costs, but we're to make sure that we're reaching and achieving our goals, we're really going to have to make sure that people bring in proposals under a certain dollar amount. So I think that that's something you should be aware of. We may have that vary, obviously, based on the typology of the unit, whether it's a family size unit or whether it's a deeply affordable supportive housing unit, which may require different kinds of functionality in terms of durability for those clientele. So I just kind of want to get you thinking about that's what you're going to be hearing on the 7th. Also to remind you that your next formal meeting besides the 7th is April 4th, which is a community meeting. It's an evening meeting, which we are hoping to host once again at ERCO, if you remember, in East Portland. And I think it's a little bit about where we've gone and then trying to get some additional feedback from the community in general on where we're going with the bond. I believe that the mayor, I think I saw Cupid here, I believe the mayor is slated to join us for that April 4th meeting again. If you remember, we did that last year. The property acquisition issue, I think we're going to be talking with you about more individually and potentially with an RFI group again. So please know we'll be communicating with you a lot. And thank you.
Are we going to address the vice chair scenario now or after Annalise joins?
I think that's a question for the committee. I would. Are you ready to do that now, or would you like to do that at the next meeting?
Maybe when we have a full committee. Yeah, I would say Annalise would probably want to have a voice in that. So.
And so she will be at the next meeting, is your understanding?
Well, we just scheduled it, and so she's not here. So I will hope that that works for her schedule. Also, City Council, there is a process, and we're doing the paperwork right now. It takes a couple of weeks, so we're hoping she's in place by the 7th, and with that timeline, we'll work forward on that.
And then are there any meetings needed for the City Council presentation in March?
Hey, Stephen, if we use the mic so everybody can hear. Thank you.
Are there any meetings needed with any of us members before the City Council meeting in March that we should schedule now or not?
I think it's a question somewhat for this committee as to whether you would like to try to work with us via email or individually on your comments. The 7th meeting will be the meeting you just sat on the 7th will be before the council presentation. So if we wanted to discuss the council presentation and you provide us feedback as a group, we can do that. But we're also happy to meet with you in individual groups of two or less.
How do you guys feel about making an agenda item for next meeting?
Are we all going to be at the council presentation? And what's the date?
So we've requested March 27th. We don't have a confirmation on that yet. So we'll be communicating when we do have a confirmation of when we can get on the council agenda with plenty of time for you to arrange your calendars for that.
And it will be time certain, I hope.
That's why we're here. That's why we're
here. We all hope. We all live in hope.
Oh, that was bad. We waited so long.
Is there, you know, as I'm saying this, as we're working with you individually, do you think it will be okay to work with you via email to get your comments and then go back to the group? Would one of you like to volunteer to take shepherding responsibility for first comments? Is there a better approach that you can think of, except for generally how we've done this with email?
I think email is fine, unless people feel differently. Yeah, I'm totally fine with email.
Well, good work, everyone. Thank you for your time and your energy. Thanks, everybody who came and stayed. Again, if you have questions or want to interact around some of the work, a lot of information covered, grab one of the staff members who can either direct you or assist you. Otherwise, have a phenomenal Thursday. Stay warm.